down to Wall Street yesterday.
Yeah, this guy's big time.
Uh-huh.
He has to kind of balance his presence.
Mm-hmm. You got to get a job after this.
Butler and Hill are.
Say a fly. You guys ready? We will convene the Thursday, May 13th iteration of the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. Continue our public hearing on Senate Bill 5506, the budget bill for Department of Corrections. And we will continue with our administration and community corrections piece. And unless anyone is just has a burning desire to continue the 145 discussions, community corrections, let's start with the budget presentation, I guess.
Yeah. The only thing I wanted to say, Chair Westland, committee members, is that there were a couple questions that came up yesterday in the context of the administration budget. I think the department wants to address those and then pick up where we left off on Senate Bill 1145.
Okay.
But Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I would just like to add a couple of points of clarification to the discussion on the records project, which we discussed yesterday. The committee had a couple of concerns that I don't think that I addressed very well. You wanted some specific information about the number of positions, where the 12 positions came from, and what they did.
Right.
So very briefly, as noted, I'm on page F42 in your book if you want to follow along. I'm looking at the organizational chart. It's under the tab marked Administration.
The big book.
Small book.
F42. Okay.
And I think the question from the members yesterday was, how do you explain the difference between the total number of FTEs? And I wanted to point out that 6 of the 12 new FTEs came about as a result of the startup of Two Rivers Correctional Institution. And those positions will be doing sentence calculation. The other 6 would provide a permanent operation for the unit that we created, and they would not contribute to the workflow of calculating the sentences. So the total now is 50, and in the next budget, the total then goes to 62. The other issue that was raised that I think that I should add a little more clarity to, and that's the question of what's the workload. And I think, Representative Westland, you did some brief calculations, and I did some checking on that. And the number that drives workload isn't simply the number of folks who are incarcerated. It includes over 5,000 folks who were added in a year, and also there are 4,100 releases in a year. And our responsibilities continue even after the inmate leaves our system, as far as managing certain aspects of the record, as well as managing records and calculating sentences for those who aren't even in the system, who may be in another correctional institution.
Representative Patrick,
you're doing all the probation and post-prison supervision. Are those calculation people doing all the probation and post-prison supervision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, we wouldn't do all of them, no. Our workload drops considerably when they leave the institution, but there's still requirements in case the inmate comes back in, and about roughly a third of them do. And if there are no other questions about that, Sue Acuff also has some clarification from yesterday.
Wait, you're admitting 5, you're letting 4 go, and with the 4, when the 4,100 leave you, you still have continued responsibilities and obligations?
Representative Ruffin, that is correct. A diminished responsibility, but nonetheless, we have to maintain files and so forth. Our records people refer to the pool as a reservoir, and those are the people that they calculate sentences on. But as inmates leave the system and as they enter the system, the workload is dramatically increased. Obviously, 3 months before they leave, they're doing preparation, making sure the calculations are correct. And as they come in, they're doing a lot of research to make sure they have all the detainers, the correct information from the county.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get hung up on it on this juncture. I mean, I'm going to talk to you a little bit more in detail. It just seems like an incredibly time-intensive, employee-intensive process. And, you're looking me in the eyes and telling me it is. I believe you. Go ahead.
Representative Wilson, that's really the only clarification I had on that. But Sue had a couple of issues related to 1145.
Well, before we go to 1145, I'm looking at this thing. I had a question yesterday and never got to. But I'm seeing that in your personnel chart that the Department of Corrections funds the governor's public safety advocate position. What is that? And why are you guys paying for it?
Mr. Chair, that's a delegated responsibility. I think there's more than just Department of Corrections who shares in that funding. It does partially come from us. I apologize. I'm too late for Department of Corrections.
So what's it do?
Mr. Chair,
I think I can answer it. If you want to
answer, that's okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Department of Corrections Director. The public safety advocate is responsible for dealing with a variety of issues that arise from constituents who have concerns about the business of the Department of Corrections, OIA, the state police, the military department, the Department of Remember, I think there are 5 or 6 different agencies, and what's happening here is the agencies are contributing to the cost of one person who basically troubleshoots problems from outside phone calls and other concerns that arise. For example, if one of your constituents was concerned about a victimization that had occurred in their community, and an inmate was sentenced under that, and the parole hearing was coming up, and they were concerned about how to do business in that area, what they had to do to arrive at a parole hearing. If they call on that issue, this public safety advocate essentially deals with those concerns. And they do that for a number of different agencies. Their caseload typically runs about 180, 220 different events that occur every month in terms of doing work with citizens.
Okay. And then I guess I'm still concerned about why you guys are paying for it.
We're paying for it because about a third to a half of the workload in any given month is DOC related. It has a lot to do with the inmates in custody. Inmates, particularly Representative Westland, when we had a number of inmates out of state on rental beds, what would happen if we were not paying for this and doing it consolidated in the way that we are, each of the agencies would have someone responsible for sort of troubleshooting these problems. By doing it in the way that we've done it with 5 or 6 different agencies contributing, I think we're actually more efficient in terms of the resolution of these issues.
And so
we're contributing to the cost.
You're paying a third to a half of the...
Actually, I think we're paying a little more than that, but we're probably the major contributor to the issues that arise.
Okay. And then while you're up there, I don't need an answer to this now, Dave, and maybe you're going to get into it in more detail, but as long as we're kind of back to administration, is what was the cost to implement the new inmate award system?
Representative Westland, we're going to get into that probably Tuesday with the inmate work program in detail.
Okay, we may have a modification to our schedule.
There's okay.
Things afoot in the building, so...
Mr. Chair, whenever you're ready for that presentation, I think it probably if we do the build up on that, give you the background on, and then explain why we went to the PRAS system as opposed to payment, it relates to some issues around the entire ballot measure 17 inmate work program process.
Yeah, and that in relation to the previous inmate compensation.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Okay.
Great. Proceed ahead, Sue.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of things to clean up some questions. On the administration portion of the budget in our 4% plan, we did have some delays with positions, both for the sentencing unit as well as community corrections. The question came up was how much was the roll-up cost for those. You'll see on here the TRCI-related positions for the sentencing unit was a total of $95,832. For the new positions coming on, it's $252,386. those in total are approximately 348,000. And for the community corrections position...
Mr. Chairman, can I stop Ms. Hayes up there? And the 95,000 roll-up cost is for four administrative specialists, two positions.
Right.
The new positions, are they basically the same or are they different? And the reason I'm asking is one is for a six-month delay roll-up cost, and one, this one is administrator by 6 months and others 1 year.
Okay.
So when you show 252,000, is that for the full biennium or is that for 1 year?
The roll-up costs are the addition, is what it would take to fund them for the entire 24 months. That's in addition to what's in the base.
I understand that, but your description here, like TRCI records office, four administrative specialists, two positions, approximately 6 months delay, roll-up cost $95,832. What is the cost of the six-month delay, and then what is the roll-up cost for next biennium where it covers 24 months? This is only for 6 months.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cannon, the savings that we have is the $95,832, and that's 6 months. So the full cost would be four times that.
Four times the $95,000?
That's correct.
And again, it would be four times the 252,000 usually below that.
For the most part, it's only two times that, because most of those positions are only delayed for 1 year. So we have one full year is already in the budget itself.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
What is that, Patrick?
This one, we're talking about roll-up costs. I mean, my understanding of roll-up costs, when I've talked about them before, what's the full cost of the position for the next client? What's the full cost of the position for the next client? Maybe when we...
Well, it's
technical. Yeah, that's easier for us to look at. Right.
It's a technical term because Ms. Acuff used to work for LFO. And so by phasing the person in over the biennium, you don't get the true reflection. What we're trying to do is find out what is the budget is slot for a full 24-month period. And that, I think...
That's what I was asking. That's your question.
Thank you.
Okay, the other question that came in was on the community corrections grant, and it was the same kind of a question on the roll-up cost for those. On this one, I did do it right the way we
It's not right or wrong. It's just how you did it.
Yeah.
So the full biennium cost there... of the new cost model, if you will, is the $13,058,481. What's currently in the governor's revised budget is the $5.54 million, and that does the funding for 10 months within the 9901 by the rest of this takes you through the funding history and the assumptions that we had from the beginning of Senate Bill 1145. If it's your pleasure, I'll go through those. Otherwise, it's there for your information. What I was attempting to do was just tell you that really the only thing that's different in the governor's revised budget this time is the department went back and worked with the counties to come up with what their actual costs were to either verify our original assumption of $55 in one jail to $7 on an alternate sanction. In that work, it was shown that the cost were higher, and the governor's revised now and does attempt to reflect those additional costs. That's the only difference in how we approach it.
Representative Patridge.
Just two quick questions, and maybe you don't have to answer them right now, Sue, but I'm interested, one, in what our cost per day is on jail beds, and I know we've been giving that at one point in time, but I have it in my notes and trying to compare it to the 75 point.
64
for the state to do it. So it's cheaper for the state to do it.
Our costs do not necessarily include the full administrative structure that is rolled into the jail cost. And I think Mr. Armenicus will talk some to that when he comes up and does an institution presentation.
Okay, then I'll wait and ask him when he's up here, because I'm interested, too, in knowing how many vets we're running back to town.
Thank you.
Sure. No worries, Mike. Yep. Mr. Taylor back up to yours, but go ahead. Ask your question.
I unfortunately wasn't able to stick around throughout all yesterday. And I apologize for that. No, a lot of things going on, but I had a general question regarding the intake center and its use thereof by the state, and how that was going to be taken care of.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections, Bill McGee, DAS Budget Analyst, and Mr. Nick Armenicus, who is the Assistant Director for Institutions, along with Mr. Frank Thompson. Nick's going to be the one here with the institutional presentation. Representative Schrader, the intake center was part of the commitment made under 1145. To be turned over to Clackamas County Sheriff's Office for the purpose of housing their 1145 offenders. I think Sheriff Bradshaw is, at this point, comfortable with the relationship with the DOC. He believes he's having his costs compensated for. He believes also that he needs those jail beds as quickly as possible. That's not going to happen unless either, number one, the sheriff tells us to leave, which he certainly has the right to do, or you all fund and site the Women's Prison Intake Center, and it's awaiting that decision. The intake center at this point is Clackamas County. Until the point that we fund and site, completely site Site 1, then we're still in business with Clackamas County. I think that will be for whatever period of time is necessary, but I also believe that Sheriff Bradshaw has got some continuing problems with releases that he's having to do out of his jail that he would prefer not to do, and I know his DA and judges would agree with him on that. So he's trying to balance the system best he can and still continue to fulfill his obligation to us to operate the intake center.
Follow-up question, Jim. So it's not a question of, as I understand it, it's really not a question of more dollars to help this thing work. It's just that we've got limited space, and as I've heard from Sheriff Asher also, we're kind of up against it. He wants to work as closely as he can with the Department of Corrections, but real life 1145 local stuff is getting in the way a little bit, and there's a public safety issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, Chris Bradshaw is one of the best sheriffs in the state. He is a good person to work with. He is somebody who understands the needs of both his agency and the department. He will, I think, stay in this as long as he can. We've attempted to turn over whatever beds we could turn to Clackamas County at the rate that was appropriate for them and for us. I think we're both bumping up against it now. We clearly are out of options in terms of intake. We cannot go below the number of beds that we're operating with now, or at least in the foreseeable future. If we're continuing to intake about 350 to 400 inmates a month, we don't have any place else to go. We can't cut the intake process any more than we have. And everybody's concerned about this, obviously.
Thank you.
So are you going to start? For the record, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services, begin the budget presentation on the institutions division. You should have my handout on this. The governor's revised budget for the institutions division is $345.2 million. General fund is a 24.4% increase over the legislative approved budget. The total funds of $357.5 million is a 21.5% increase from the ledger approved budget. The issues in this division are the population growth in the April through the April 99 forecast, postponing operation of the Women's Prison Intake Center until the 2103 biennium, increased payment to the Clackamas County Sheriff for the operation of the Intake Center, captured savings in inmate care that are being transferred to another division to open the warehouse and distribution center, and increased reliance on federal criminal alien assistance funds. Our starting point here in the alleged adopted budget was $271.6 million general fund and $288.2 million total funds, with
just under 20, with 2,239.66 full-time equivalent FTE. The emergency board issue here really was just a salary adjustment. Current service level, generally, again, the same issues you've seen, additional inflationary costs, start up the Women's Prison Intake Center, start up and operations for Two Rivers Correctional Institution, phase in of new beds at Snake River Correctional Institution, the population changes into the prison in 1145 through the October 98 forecast, elimination of one-time costs for prison construction for beds that opened in this biennium. Specific issues in this are a shift to some operations costs to federal state criminal alien assistance program funds. We'll have a larger transfer there in the policy packages. And technical adjustments that shift funding for the psychological services at the state penitentiary special management unit to the corrections program division. That's a net $0 impact on the agency overall. The packages, again, the program reduction in this division shifts an additional $4 million in operations costs to the federal state criminal alien assistance program. It also shifts anticipated savings in food costs to the central support and operations division to open and operate the new warehouse and distribution center. You've heard testimony on before. So the net effect is a general fund reduction of $7.1 million and an other funds reduction of $3.1 million. Back to 94, again, shifts the Women's Prison Intake Center into the 2001-03 biennium. Package 95 takes the reductions we've talked about before for Two Rivers, delaying one unit by 1 month, delaying all new hires by a week, eliminating PERS for new hires for the first 6 months, and reducing S&S by 15%. And the impact of that is a $4.2 million general fund reduction and total funds reduction. The specific packages for this program unit, the first 130 increases the payment to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office for services provided to the intake center for security, food, medical services, and state inmates. This funds the Sheriff's Office at what the actual cost of maintaining the intake center is. It's been underfunded for a period of years now. That's a $1.3 million general fund impact.
Mr. Chairman. Bill. That package 130, if it was underfunded for several years, what is the funding that drives it? Is it actual cost, a portion of actual cost, or is it a contract that they have with DOC?
Mr. Chairman Hannon, there has been a contract with the department for a period of time. In prior biennium, that contract was increased by the standard inflation rate biennium.
But that's not enough to increase.
It's not been enough. So the department and the sheriff's office negotiated a rate that would be actual reimburse the department, the sheriff's office for what the cost of providing those services.
So they negotiated a new contract, and this is funding under the provisions of the new contract.
That'd be correct.
And what's the length of time for the contract?
I think it's a 2-year contract.
Can't answer it.
Yes, we'll get back.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to know if we're going to start taking more substantial hits than what the minimum inflation shows.
We hope to get the intake center open in the next few years and not have to continue to make these payments.
Senator Hinn, let me add also that the situation with Clackamas County is that DOC actually does the intake process. Clackamas County is responsible for the security. And this is a situation where we have negotiated not only the rate for compensation to them, but the number of security staff necessary in a given location. So we've had, in the last several years, a better dialogue about what's necessary and what those costs ought to be, and I think we're on track to basically move ahead at a reasonable rate of inflation.
Are these county employees under contract to you?
No, sir. These are county employees who work for the sheriff and provide security to the Department of Corrections for this intake population. So they actually report to and operate under the authority of the sheriff.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure. There, Tim.
Dave, what's it cost to build an intake center? I should know that. I should ask Larry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Timms, that would depend, obviously, on the intake center you want to build.
Right, but the one that you're looking at building with
with the new...
The intake center portion of the Women's Prison Intake Center, I'll have to get the number from Sue, we are planning to build about 430 or so beds for intake purposes, and it's hard to disaggregate the intake center alone because you're talking about infrastructure issues and a whole array of other things. We can provide that information to you tomorrow, or that should be on Tuesday, I guess, in continuing conversation with this group.
Because I've heard that from other senators that, you know, they would build a intake center, as you have. I know that you've met with them, to establish and take care of this, of the intake problem, and then use other things for the, so we wouldn't have to build the additional prison for the women.
Mr.
Chair, yes. I think that Senator Metzger is the one that's been meeting with you in regards to that. He was telling me all the ways we could save money. So I'd be interested to look at what that intake center would cost.
Separate freestanding.
Yes. Or any other way that they could think to make it more economical with a prison facility that's already been built.
Mr. Chair, Senator Timms, we can provide you the information that we have based upon the conversations we've had. There obviously could be another 10 or 20 permutations of this. We can give you what we've done to date based upon the direction that we got.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Just trying to piggyback on Senator Timms' question. I think we need a complete representation, not just a standalone intake facility, but does that have an implication on how much a standalone women's prison or if it's done in Eastern, would we build Eastern a little differently to handle that? So we know the total cost of the overall picture in isolation. I just want to show you a good representation of the long-term effects.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I think we can provide you with the several options that exist and what the potential positive and negative aspects of that are.
Senator
Hanson. Yeah, Dave, are we going to be looking at some cost comparison between building our own intake center versus contracting that service out? Is that the essence of the question you're going to try to respond to? And the reason I ask it is for a purpose. If we say we can do this on a contract basis, and we go over here and we say, but we can save some money and not build in our own intake center, is that being prudent and wise in assuming that we will always have a contract with Clackamas County?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cannon, it would be my opinion that any sort of contracted intake center is probably not a good idea. And in terms of any discussion around privatization, there has not been any discussion about having non-DOC operation of an intake center, simply because the duties and the activities that occur there are not compatible with what private sector does. And in this situation with Clackamas County at the time of the decision, there may have been some logical reasons to do it. I think it did not take into account, unfortunately, the rapid growth that the DOC has seen because of sentencing practice.
Thanks. I just wanted to follow
up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on, package 132 is a radio maintenance program package. This would allow the department basically to repair its own radios. Currently, the Department of Forestry provides the service under contract. We can fund startup and operations costs with savings by reducing the contract with forestry. Savings will be ongoing. We have some additional cost reductions here in the governor's revised budget. So at this point, there's two positions here. We'll show some savings a little bit later in the presentation. Package 138 shifts a position in the canteen at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution from general fund to other funds and adds an additional position that's entirely supported by other funds. So it reduces general fund by $88,000, increases total funds by $74,000, and adds position. Moving on to the governor's revised budget, the first item here is a result of the April 99 forecast. Delays half of the intensive management unit beds at Snake River by 2 years, delays all beds at Two Rivers facilities by 1 month, and increases the use of temporary beds. As I said, that accommodates the slight reduction in the growth rate in the last forecast. Next issue is a reduction in the intake center contract with Clackamas County by 20 beds. Saves some money, provides a little relief to the sheriff's office there as well. Reduced staffing at Two Rivers by 15% to reflect operational efficiencies. You'll see that in most of the divisions here again. Next item, delays implementation of the televideo visiting system at Two Rivers. So the department is going to run a pilot on that before they actually decide whether or not to roll out a full operation on that that operation. Next, startup equipment purchases at Two Rivers is shifted to other funds with COP dollars. The inflation allowance is reduced by 17% from $2.7 million to $2.2 million in this division. And finally, there's a reduction in funding for the emergency equipment and repair budget, and there's also additional savings anticipated from the radio repair program in package 132. The technical adjustments here restores a reduction in services supplies for sure and startup operations that was taken twice to correct an error. There's just a position count error at Two Rivers also that really doesn't impact dollars at all. It simply is we had the wrong number recorded there for positions. Transfer one position to central support and operations and two from corrections programs and intake work programs. Again, the position transfers have no dollar effect agency-wide. There's a shift in funds to central support and operations for operations of the distribution center. We're adjusting that to correct an error there. And finally, we're continuing as permanent two limited duration positions for canteen operations with other funds. The impact of the revisions of the governor's budget reduces general fund by $12.6 million general fund and reduces total funds by 12.5 and eliminates 64 positions and reduces FTE by 84.44. The difference from the legislative budget are the elimination of the one-time cost for construction and startup of the new and expanded institutions, and there are also significant reductions from current service level and startup and operations costs. Presentation.
Any questions for Bill on the DAS report?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are going to present the institutional budget to you. Mr. Arminicus is here to contribute to the conversation, answer any questions that you have. They have, in their division, arrayed the talking points for me a little bit differently. So if you have your smaller book near you, you can actually follow along in the design of this piece, and we'll try to keep this on track so that you guys know where you're going. I have some clue where I can. We're starting with page E1, which is the first page of the institutional tab. And this will give you a graphic overview of what the organization, the institutional side, looks like. You'll notice the structure of the situation and see the institutional administration line positions there. The basic positions are obviously all day-to-day operational people in the institutions. E2, next page in the book, is the expenditure summary, reflects the growth in the system. This would recognize the April 1999 forecast with 1,612 additional offenders expected under the forecast by the end of the biennium. Primary factors driving the increase in the governor's budget are occupancy at Snake River Correctional Institution in Mount Hare County. That will have an average daily population count of 2,948. As Bill indicated, that would indicates the non-opening at this point of the IMU, the intensive management unit, which we believe will not be necessary to occupy at this point. We are still in relatively good shape with those special purpose beds. And then the opening of the 96 minimum beds at Two Rivers in Umatilla and the additional 1,248 beds that will be opened by 6:30 of 2001. Bill's already done for you pages E3, E4, E5, and E6 in his highlight. We're going to move in to E7. You can skip over that. The cover sheet is basically providing you some information.
Hold on a second, Dave.
Back on E2, I mean, I understand the reductions that the agency came in with and then the governor's revised budget, but I'm just trying to rationalize how to approach the positions there. The current service level for 9901 goes from 3,024, and our new revise is 2,711, and that's only 300 above the 9799. And I understand that we've made some adjustments. does that imply there was room that we should have been looking at prior to this in terms of how we looked at the CSL or how we looked at calculating things, and does this have an implication as to how we're going to be looking at things in the future, building on the new CSL?
The current service level was based on the October, either April or October of 99 population forecast. The governor's revised budget comes in and it picks up April of 99, and some of the adjustments that were made here change what's happening at Two Rivers and Snake River. We're picking up temporary beds, and so there's less staffing involved in the new population management plan.
The other thing I would add to Sue's comments is that over about 259 of those position reductions relate to pushing out the Women's Prison Intake Center operating this biennium out for next biennium. And so that would have been originally included in the current service level budget.
And if you'd like to, at any point, we'll have Sue come up and talk about the population management plan. I think Larry can address some of that in Bill as well. But she's the expert in that, and we'll have her walk through it again if that's helpful to you. But we make at every forecast significant, well, not always significant, we make adjustments, sometimes significant, to the population management plan, kind of based upon events and what we expect to have to do.
Dave, related to population forecast, I mean, I understand it drives everything you do, but so partially in relation to that, but, you know, if I were to look at a list of positions that have been vacant for the last 6 months or so, I mean, how many would I find? And what's the reasons for those institutional positions being left vacant? I'm talking institutional positions. You want to answer that, Nick? Or?
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, the reason for that is cost savings. My name, for the record, is Nick Armenica, Assistant Director for Department of Corrections Institution Division. The majority of those vacancies for a lengthy period of time are cost savings. And we talked about expenditures and saving money in a particular area, and those are the spots that we look at rolling up money.
How many would I find, Nick? Six that have been vacant for 6 months or more.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I can't answer that question.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a number either, but one other reason you'd see vacancies would be positions that are facing at a later point in the biennium. As we're adding institutions, we're not bringing the positions on until a period of time before the beds open. So at any point, you'd see a number of vacancies that are there because the positions were actually established, but the actual funding in FTE doesn't start until a later point in the biennium. So we'll get the number for you, but there's a couple of reasons why you'd see numbers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's true. With the intensive management unit at the Snake River, those positions were allocated to us, but they were vacant. They kept vacant because they were not funded.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannah,
when you talk about the intensive management unit in Baker or Ontario?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannah in Ontario.
Ontario, okay. When you use that definition, I haven't had the good fortune to go over there yet and see it because I don't know what it all involves. Is that like your intensive management unit here where you have the security people and then the cells are kind of in a circular fashion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannah, that is correct. It's similar to the intensive management unit inside the Oregon State Penitentiary.
Right. And are you now starting to place such facilities as say like medium security facilities will have a intensive care management unit too.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, we have one intensive management unit located on the west side and one located on the east side at this time. The Two Rivers Correctional Institution will not have an intensive management unit.
Will Pendleton possibly get one at some point?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, not this time, that has not been considered.
So if a person in Pendleton, as an example, acts out of aggression or whatever, they'd be sent down to Ontario or brought back to Ontario.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, that the plan would be they would move to Snake River. That would be Ontario.
Ontario.
That's right. Snake River.
Snake River.
Okay.
Now, does that drive the cost? And I'm trying to find out
then we got institutional costs, and then we have all these management techniques that we use in institutions.
Is it pretty expensive to transport
somebody that's acting out in Pendleton or Hermiston or wherever they might be up there to Ontario and say, you're going to serve time for misbehaving in here?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Abraham, the special management unit has, as we talked about, the intensive management unit is a highly staffed, intensive operation. It includes psychologists, education, a lot of people who deals with behavioral problems in inmates. Because of that type of staffing and the needs that go along with the operation of that type of facility, it's better economy of scale to transport rather than duplicate that process.
I see.
Okay. That is, Senator, why we're not opening the second 48 beds of Snake River, or the, pardon me, yeah, 48 beds in that intensive management unit at this point, because we, that IMU actually sort of works as a percentage of the total number of inmates in the system, and we try to not open those expensive beds unless we absolutely need them. We're still able to manage within the beds here at OSP. But because of transportation and other reasons, it makes sense to open Snake River at this point and serve PRCI, Pendleton, and SRCI out of that same institution.
Where, Dave, are we at? I was reading here a little bit ago about the April forecast and facilities to reflect that April forecast. How much of a deviation above or below the April forecast are we headed, and are we headed for potentially more bed space at the same time we're postponing the intake and the women's prison till 2001-2003?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, the last three forecasts generally have been pretty consistent with the numbers. The difficulty comes in the fact that the longer we go, the worse position we as a state are in terms of handling women, obviously because of a lack of women's space. We are well beyond our commitment to Clackamas County on intake. And then as far as the population goes, what has to be done in addition to that, and that's why Sue can talk more about the population management plan, you're really talking about a whole array of custody issues and other things that come into play, and what we're going to find ourselves in the position to have to deal with is having more minimum custody inmates than was anticipated, and having to accelerate the construction of some of the minimum custody facilities on top of moving the Women Prison Intake Center to as far as we can up the list for construction date. And to this point, obviously, we're bogged down in terms of being able to do that. So we're getting worse with women. We're going to have to accelerate minimum custody beds and continue to open the medium custody beds at TRCI and Snake River.
But the obligation doesn't leave because you postponed your decision not to move ahead. Is that fair assumption?
Senator, I think you're going to have to ask that again. I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, you just stated you're going to have potential conflicts or potential problems with the women's facility and possibly overcrowding, whatever else is involved. By postponing it for one more biennium, it still identifies as a potential problem, isn't it? That, I mean, it's like the old guy on the oil advertising, you either pay me now or pay me later, but eventually we got to pay the price to lock somebody up. So is it cheaper to do it now, or I know the political minefield is out there, but is it more prudent to invest now than to wait later and have the construction costs and the inflation costs and everything else drive the locomotive that we're going to be back here 2 years from now? Sam, but if we had only taken a stand in 1999, we wouldn't be having to eat this additional cost.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, we would agree with you. We think the cost will continue to escalate. We think it isn't wise to put off a decision. But in addition to that, as you said earlier, the DOC has to take all comers. We don't get to pick and choose who comes to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And when they show up at the gate, we have to have a place to put them, which means that we would either rent beds, if we have to do that, and ultimately in 01, and Nick will talk about that, we'll be renting beds someplace. We definitely have to find a place for women, and we are well over capacity in all our options. We've used up our options at this point.
So are you saying that they're going out of state?
Mr. Chair, I'm not saying the women are going out of state. Some inmates will go out of state. We have not made the final decision on that. It's my belief, and I think that we're probably going to eventually get to this point, we'll do what we can to house women here in the state and send the males out first. But that will depend on the options we have available. And I don't know what, you know, the forecast is one thing, reality is something else. And so I don't know what's going to happen 18 months down the road. We have to do this.
Did you put in this budget any additional dollars for renting out of state beds?
Yes, we did.
About how much?
$2 million.
About $2 million?
Senator, to follow up on that question, then,
Senator Rakoff said that the going rate on a prisoner is $64 per day.
I believe it was approximately that. I wasn't here.
Yeah,
approximately. And what is it for bed space outside the state?
It varies, Senator Hannon. Right now, though, we have a contract we've just negotiated with U.S. Corrections, one of the private firms, for a 3-year contract that I believe is in the range of about $55 a day. And as Senator, as Representative Ruffin just said, the $2 million is $2 million, but those are, we'd either be paying that for operating in-state or operating out-of-state. In this particular case, we've got a pretty good deal on male rental beds. That isn't always the case. We've paid in excess of $70 a day for female beds in the past, so it depends on whether it's a buyer or seller's market. And with this particular company, we have a 3-year contract at a fixed rate or no cap on the number of offenders that we want to use. And that's thanks to some people in our agency doing the negotiations.
Okay, so there is a potential net savings.
There's potentially a net savings that does not include the cost that we have in state for managing those people. We have to have monitors, health care monitors, and other issues, plus transportation. So you're not net 55, but you're in a $55 a day contract, there may be some savings that will accrue to the state.
Yep.
But I wouldn't want to say that it's going to be any very large.
Representative Schrader.
But if I understand what you're saying correctly, I mean, although $2 million we'd be spending is somewhat in operations, we still have to site a women's prison. We still have to pay and gear up for operations there. We're paying for it. Because I heard at one point that, geez, you know, if you assume one group's numbers, it's going to save us $2 million biennium here in the long term, and here we're paying $2 million just to send the thing out because we're avoiding the decision. I don't see where we're saving stuff in the long run. It sounds like we're spending money and not getting any closer to a solution.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to show you, in the short term, for the 9901 budget, we were able to save about $19 million by postponing the operation in the prison program, which was in current service levels scheduled up in the last 6 months of the biennium. And what we primarily did was able to postpone the startup costs until at some point early in the next biennium. And the cost of doing that was approximately $2 million to rent beds in those 6 months. Eventually, we will have to open that prison. We will have to spend those dollars. No question.
Quick follow-up to this: like, you know, are you going to rent or are you going to own?
I'd like to know, maybe you've already given us a figure on this, but by putting it off another biennium, what's the roll-up cost for the facility compared to what we originally envisioned?
We'll need to get back to you on that.
The only thing I can
say is you might have an idea.
The cost is escalating. When it was initially approved to be sited and built at Camish, it was approximately $151 million. In the budget that's before you right now, they're asking for expenditure limitation increase to take it up to around $173 million, depending on what they find in terms of ways to reduce those costs. Based on some recent cost analysis information they're doing, it might come down a little bit from that, but nonetheless, the cost has increased over time and will continue to increase, you know, as inflation and materials costs go up.
Okay. I think this highlights a problem here is that the role of a pretty business person wouldn't be to wait. If they were going to invest in their own business, they would make the investment and start assuming the capitalization required to make it work. But postponing the inevitable and allowing inflation
and time to increase the cost by a third is just postponing the inevitable. Mm-hmm.
So
I don't want to go too far out on a limb here, but...
No, I don't either, but I think it needs to be catered for the maker of this budget.
Well, Mr. Chair, we are going to speak more about some of these issues towards the end of the presentation as well.
Okay.
Right. I just had a folder handed to me today, private prisons, and the important stuff. We see a decline in the cost in the United States of a prison bed because of competition, because there's more people getting into the business. The private side you used to never hear about, and now you're hearing about it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Timms, the private sector for the construction and operations of prisons is a growing business, in some cases a rapidly growing business in several states. The cost savings, though, that are promised by various companies have not, from any kind of research-based analysis, been validated. There are a number of studies that exist. I think you can find people that will hold up a study on one hand and a study on the other hand, and they will not necessarily agree. There is no clear and convincing evidence at this point that there is, through the effect of competition, a reduction in the cost.
Mr. Chair, of course, this is something that's happening, and it's news. And I saw a deal on 60 Minutes, I think, last week on private prisons, and well, this one was really fouled up. But the point is, if it is being refined, and it is being done, and just because we say a bed costs so much today doesn't necessarily mean that that bed might get cheaper. For the reason you're going to have competition in the system. The process has changed. Prisons are big business. Look at Umatilla County wants one so bad. So you can look around and there's lots of areas that want to have prisons. So I think that, you know, to say that we have to do this now is not as important as doing it prudently when we do it and when we need it. And right now we have a surplus to a degree, and correct me if I'm wrong, of maximum security. Where we need to get to is the minimum security, which costs less.
Well, not to take umbrage with my esteemed co-chair, but I attended numerous seminars on this subject during the interim, and there was very inconclusive evidence that there was any savings whatsoever. The key to the whole issue is in your request for your proposal, writing that strictly enough and finitely enough that the bid that comes back from the private purveyor is actually providing the same service, amenities, I mean everything down to pillows on the bed that your public agencies provide. And when you do that, you find that there just isn't the savings. I would suggest, and not to take a, I agree. I mean, anything can be explored, and we shouldn't rule out any options. But the delay, the cost increase is based on the delay, would more than eat up any potential savings in a private institution.
Just another point, and I think Dave has learned, we have learned in the building of the prisons we've currently built. Now go to Snake River. But I mean, if you want to see a Taj Mahal, it's a Taj Mahal. Well, it's got these big corridors and what, and we know that we did that because of ballot measure 11 and those type things that created those problems as far as moving prisons around. But when we look, we learn in building.
Mm-hmm.
And we can build them cheaper and probably do a better job of how we handle inmates in the whole process. And the audit showed that the department was doing that. So to say that, you know, that the system's going to stay the same, it isn't. It's going to be a very changing type industry because there's big money in it. There's big money in this system. There's no bigger money, all of government and prisons. And because of that, I think there'd be competition. That's the American way. I don't see it getting, maybe it could get cheaper.
I think it will get cheaper. More efficient, more refined designs, better designs on down the road. Like I say, not to spend a lot of time on the privatization of it. Represent the staff on the station.
Just in the context of the comments about delaying, the cost of delaying, the budget does delay the operation of the intake center, but I don't want to be confused with the fact that it doesn't, it assumes the decision surrounding siting and actual starting of construction is not delayed. It assumes that this body will make some decisions and move forward so that within this biennium, the construction does start.
Representative Schrader?
Real quick little thing on the privatization, because I'm not that familiar with that, and I wonder if there's a safety concern. In other words, is it only certain types of prisons that, you know, minimum security that are being explored there? Offhand, just as a layperson, be a little concerned at looking at a, you know, privatizing a maximum or maybe even medium security, but I don't know enough about it.
Security really wasn't an issue, I mean, large issue. Well, they can keep them inside there. Representative Patridge.
That's all I'm showing you to do. I mean, as we look at private, we could sit here all day and discuss prison costs, and we have the
study.
People in here before on the audit, and the other thing is the prison costs. My concern, though, too, is on the other side, when we had 1145 that was passed, and now we've moved all these people down to the county level, we're going to fund it for 7582 at the county level for the 1145 dollars for beds, even though I know part of them were trying to filter off in some other alternative forms of testing. And if our level, even though it's 6464, is if the state level is only 6464, absent any administration, I'm interested to know what that administration figure is. And I'm wondering if it's cheaper for the state to have those 1145 prisoners instead of having them with local jurisdiction in the country we're at. To flip the side of it around. I mean, are we doing a more efficient job at the state level because of sheer volume? Are we the Walmart of handling prisons?
Oh, a comment on that. I thought the average, though, the number maybe, and this is the discussion with it, the discussion I gathered from yesterday was that, you know, you don't automatically get $75. Just there's this formula and ratio and all sorts of things they put into it to determine how much they actually get in the county. And also, the 75 was just for the bed portion. The average weighted thing that Mr. Taylor indicated was in the $64 range.
The average weight, Representative Schrader, is essentially the same for 1145 offenders as it is for the prisons. And as Sue pointed out, the administrative costs are not included in the DOC figure. The other thing, Representative Patridge, I think is important to recognize in this, were some of the costs associated with bringing inmates back into the system. The most expensive beds we operate are the intake beds. And every offender who comes back in again on a short stay like that is eating up a lot of intake bed time. So I would say if you were looking at an average per diem cost for an 1145 offender versus somebody who's doing long-term sentences, it would be higher on a per capita basis. And I think the one important issue here that make it loss 1145 is that it's I think essential to remember that those people that were coming in for short periods of time have been out in the community. They were there briefly. They were coming back into the institutions. They are reassociating with some of their previous buddies in the institution. I think it was disruptive for both systems, and I think if Scott was still here, could talk about that. The advantages to this system are that you are essentially disaggregating those two populations that are appropriately housed at DOC. We're going to get into it in just a minute here, the types of offenders now in the prison system versus what was the case back in the 1980s, and I think it's pretty dramatic in terms of the violent and dangerous offenders that are now housed in the prison system that were not there 10 years ago for the length of stay that they are today.
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, I also think, though, that from a recidivism rate and from the people that I prosecuted, the scariest thing for them was to go to the pen. It was not to be, take a good time at county jail to get out of their head. It was one of the, that's the flip side of the public policy debate that we have to make that decision. And, I appreciate that. I want to
enter into that other part as well. Like, it scares people to have to go to the Senate. They'll do almost anything to avoid trying to go to the state penitentiary.
We were going to proceed, sir, if that's okay. We're going page 8.
This is alacrity. You got to love this commission. We follow rabbit trails.
Wherever you take it,
Harry. That's all hands, Gerald. That's quite all right.
I apologize.
He's a good rabbit dog.
We are on page E8. We're looking at the institution's division overview at this point. The institution's division is responsible for security, inmate housing, the day-to-day operations of the state's adult correctional facilities that house adults, felony offenders, and certain juveniles with sentences greater than 12 months. By way of clarification on certain issues, offenders under the age of 20 years of age, using May 1, 1999 data, there are 209 of our total population that are 19 years of age, 79 of them are 18 years of age, 18 who are 17, and 3 who are 16 years of age. The OYA houses about 291 of these offenders, the DOC about 309.
Dave, does DOC contract with Oregon Youth Authority to take some of these younger persons and then ultimately move them over to DOC when they reach an age?
Nick, sir, can go into great detail on this if you'd like to, but there is no contracting that goes on. They're either in OYA or they're in the DOC. They're the responsibility of one agency or another, but there is no money changing hands as part of the process.
Is there a reason for that? The reason I'm asking is that you have a 17 or 18-year-old young person who might have started out with OYA, and now, and if you recall, when I went to the facility area recently, that 17, 18, 19-year-old kid that he had been in the social management unit. Were they actually incarcerated by Oregon Youth Authority, or were they incarcerated because they reached a certain age and moved them over to Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, actually, no. They were there probably for several reasons. The ones that would be in the IMU, most likely, and I don't know this to be true in every situation, but most likely they would be those who the OYA had basically run out of options on. They were beyond the control of the Youth Authority, and they were actually, I think, probably, in, I don't know how to express this other than just to say it contaminates the process that OYA uses. If they have patently disruptive and violent people in their institutions, they have a number of kids who are still doing very, very well in their programming, and what they don't need are mentors and role models who are violent, dangerous people, and those are the ones who should be coming to the DOC. We have a very good working relationship with OYA in terms of that. They send us the ones who are appropriately coming to us, and they'll hold on to the kids as long as they can to continue who are interested in programming, who are doing well.
Okay. Is the ultimate goal to have an interagency contract between the two?
Not at all.
To keep them separate, maintain that separate operation.
Well, I think that the mission is clearly somewhat different. The OYA is going to deal with those children who still have opportunities to be successful in that environment. If the OYA and the DOC believe that certain kids should be coming to the Department of Corrections because of the programming that we can offer, because of the control mechanisms, then we're going to get them. And I think what we have is a fairly good relationship that deals with the reality of the issues. And we have not requested, or I don't think OYA would request, any sort of contract to do that. It's a relatively dynamic environment for each of those people that come along.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, those kids are included in the population forecast for each of these agencies.
For the DOC?
And OYA. So the ones who are sent from DOC, as all of them are in the legal custody, are sent to OYA. The OYA forecast includes those kids they have. The ones that are sent back to DOC, the DOC forecast includes them. So you get the adjusted forecast based on where the kids are physically being held, and you fund the agencies based on that.
Okay. All right.
And I might just pull the read-up and clarify this, and I didn't hear if Bill covered this, but the way the law reads right now is there's the custody of the DOC and they're at OYA, they can stay there until 25.
And then they'll be released?
Either they're released prior to 25 or they can't move them. Then they're in, they move them to DOC at 25.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So the maximum age at OYA is 25.
Otherwise, OYA and DOC can move them sooner than that if they're not amenable to treatment.
Oh, okay. All right.
And we quite frankly, looked at that because there's a considerable savings if they have the OYA kids transferred out at 18 to DOC because it costs literally half as much to keep the DOC as OYA. Start getting some policy issues, and you say, we'll take it to 21, which I think you make a pretty strong argument for. But by that time, I mean, the savings are minimal.
Yeah.
You're just not moving that many kids. And like Rick testified, I mean, there's some, what's the youngest person you have in DOC?
Mr. Chair, the youngest we have is 16, and I believe we have three of kids of that age.
Yeah, Rick was testifying there's some real hard nuts that don't want to do kiddie time at OYA. So, before we move off to E9, I'm seeing Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution as one of the highest staffing, or lowest staffing to prisoner ratios. I mean, you look at Snake River, and that's higher as well as it should be. But there's an employee relation, there's an overtime issue associated with EOCI. Dave, could you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, yes, I can, and Nick can certainly add into this conversation. It is, I think, pretty accurate to say that we have, over the course of the last several years, been able to start up new institutions and operate them at what I would consider to be an appropriate staffing level. For some of the older institutions, it has been very, very difficult to get the level of staffing that we would like to see. On the other hand, that's not necessarily going to change, and I think the reality is that we operate safe institutions. It may be that institutions that have relatively similar populations don't have staffing ratios that are identical, but that might be the case for a whole array of different reasons. We might be putting different types of prisoners at certain locations. There are going to be variations in the system, and I don't know that we're ever going to be able to absolutely address like ratios of staffing to each of the institutions. And I guess my answer is they are different. They'll probably remain different, but it's a little like the situation now where you have where we are willing to a degree to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to build new institutions, but we have a $75 million hole in our deferred maintenance budget. It's a similar problem. We have old institutions that are not getting the kind of update that they need, but I don't think you're willing to spend a whole lot more for support of the DOC in that effort either, because we're a growing budget, and we have to manage within the budget that you and the governor believe is appropriate.
Let's see. Maybe if we could get prison workforce at the state fair bond for their labor, they could do the fair's deferred maintenance and the department's all in one cell bonding issue.
You know, Mr. Chairman, that's not such a weird idea.
I want to make a point for Senator Timms. I mean, you look at some of the other staffing ratios on page E9 there, Senator Timms, and you see there, you know, the best staffing ratio, most efficient staffing ratio was our newest prison. And, you know, I mean, granted, I mean, that thing is fairly large, and I don't want to put any words in Dave's mouth. I think he would do some things differently over there, given the opportunity to do that. But the most expensive part of this whole thing is the operations side. And as big and Taj Mahal-y as that thing is, it still has the most efficient operations. So it is evolving. I mean, this
is evolving.
The prison industry is evolving. I mean, I agree with you there, and there's a good example. No, Dave, what I was talking about was more, there's some vacations, person leave time issues at EOCI. Not that they're necessarily a high staffing ratio.
Mr. Chair, I should have looked at this chart before I started talking about it. This particular chart, E9, is the administrative staff to program staff chart. What that shows you is the essentially the administrators to staff ratio, not the inmate to staff ratio. That chart is located on E13, Ben.
Oh.
A different chart. I didn't look at it before we started down this trail.
It shows the same thing.
No, it'll show something different, I'm certain, unfortunately.
You mean you're going to make Senator
Kennedy
right?
Well, I don't know about that. You're right. There are some issues at EOCI. We are working now with our superintendent. We have been working with AFSCME over the course of the last several days and Representative Minnis to discuss this issue. We think we have a resolution to the problem. It has to do with us providing more appropriately spaced vacation bid slots for AFSCME employees. We're dealing with that issue. I think we'll have it resolved probably by the time we get done testifying here next week.
Representative Minnis.
Thank you. On that very point, my concern overall is the information I'm getting that because of insufficient FTEs, not sufficient staff, that there's a significant amount of overtime that's served, that there's a restriction on the capability to take vacation. And in the short term, I can understand that because one makes temporary adjustments. If there's a chronic element to the problem, then we need to own up to it and hire the necessary staff so that people are not working overtime and are able to get their training time as well as their vacation time. And I'd like to see a scenario where when we look at this, we're seeing appropriate FTE where we can say the staff are able to take the right amount of average vacation, et cetera, et cetera, and get the training time in too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I do not disagree with you at all. I believe that you do have some differences of opinion between the unions and between management and DOC about whether staffing is really the issue here. As it happens at EOCI, and using that as an example, one of the problems is that it's for most of us the summertime and the early fall and hunting season for a lot of people are important vacation times, and it's difficult to staff a 24-hour day, 365-day-a-year operation so that you have the plum vacation spots open for the maximum number of people. We're going to try to work on that to try to strategize around it, but by hiring full-time employees to boost the FTE isn't necessarily our problem. We think we might have some other strategies. I suspect we'll be in an arm wrestling match for a long time with the unions over whether or not we are staffing at the appropriate level, and I don't know if that debate's ever going to change.
There's a difference between staffing at the appropriate level to have enough people on hand during a given shift for security and operational needs, and staffing at the appropriate level to have enough people on board so you're not telling people you can't, oh yes, you've got, I'm making this up, okay, you've got 4 weeks of crew vacation, however, this year you can only take 2 weeks because we don't have enough people to cover, or you've got to do an extra hour of overtime every day for the next 6 months because we just don't have enough people to cover. Short-term specific needs are one thing. Chronic would become another. And I just would like to make sure that we don't have a pattern where people who have accrued vacation are told that within the next year's time frame or some reasonable time frame, they can't use it, or that they're told they have to do overtime, not on a spot basis I'm talking about again, but on a chronic basis. Now, I've just heard concerns about that. I'm not accepting that at face value. I'm just saying that's an issue I want to make sure we address. And if I may, for 30 seconds, I'll mention that my wife works as a nurse at Salem Hospital in the coronary care unit. And I'm fed up with that management of that hospital because she is constantly called in an hour early, asked to work 2 extra hours. They may tell you that they don't have a staffing problem, but I'll tell you that they do because responsible people are chronically being asked to work overtime. And not because they want it, not because they need the money, but because they haven't got the people to do the job. And by the way, she's also been told she can only take 3 weeks vacation a year, even though she accrues 4. That doesn't sit well. I'm not here to talk about personal issues, except I relate to the working person who is told that somehow they don't get the opportunity to get what they earn. And your contract can say all kinds of wonderful things, but if you don't deliver, I'm concerned. And again, I don't want to jump to the conclusion that that's the case on a widespread basis, or even in any given institution within DOC. I'm just saying, let's make sure, this is our chance, if there's some adjustments we can make to make sure that's not the problem, let's do it.
I don't think your assessment is inaccurate. I'm not sure it's chronic, but I think there are issues, and I think you're you're accurate in your assessment.
And David indicated he's aware of what's going on. He's going to get back to us with a potential solution. It sounded like pretty quickly, so let's move on to the
next
question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have a question?
No? Mr. Chair.
Senator Tim, excuse me.
You have a comparison to other states as far as the staff ratios. When we're looking at a prison of 2,948 prisoners inmates, I guess I should say that once you see how that operation works, that you'll be able to get more efficiencies out of it and a better ratio.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tim must have been reading ahead. No, you're really. No, you're fine.
Let's move it.
I know where we are. There is a variation in staffing, and we do have at the bottom of that page a comparison with staffing for several other states. I guess this could be a very long conversation. And we probably don't need to go into all the detail, but the age of the institutions, the design of the institutions, the types of offenders in those institutions do drive the staffing ratio. The outlier here in terms of efficiency is clearly the California Department of Corrections at 6.6 inmates per staff. You'll see that Oregon, Idaho, and Washington are all relatively similar in terms of the staffing ratios. But if you look at the national average, we are more efficient than the national average. We are significantly less efficient than the state of California because of a design and programmatic operational decision California makes. Oregon has for a number of years worked on a direct supervision model, meaning the correctional officers are in working with the inmates. Their job is to discipline, to direct, to mentor, to model behavior for inmates. In the state of California, what you have is a situation where the state of California operates an institution with one officer for 200 inmates, guns are present, and the officers do not have direct contact with the inmates. If Oregon wants to operate in that sort of fashion, they certainly could choose to do it. The difference in recidivism and the difference in violence in the institution is dramatic between the two states.
Well, I didn't want to complete it.
Oh, no, I think it's...
What I wanted to know is, couldn't we expect efficiencies with a prison that of 2,948 that we've just opened up, and we're looking at these ratios currently, but shouldn't we expect and demand that we get better efficiencies in that process?
Yes.
So we could count on that in the budget next session when you're doing this.
I'll bet you Unitilla
gets the modular one, probably. Because that's the best and most efficient way of building prisons, and that's, you know, what we want to relate to and how we do it and do it better.
Because I think you're exactly right. I think in Snake River is a situation where design and other decisions are driving a staffing ratio that is not as efficient as we would like it to be. And that, as you just spoke about with the audit, and the learning that goes on, there are some decisions that we will make that will enhance that. And I think Bill's already indicated we took a 15% reduction against the original staffing ratio at TRCI to try to drive down or try to improve those ratios. Part of that, though, does relate to the smaller management and things that we put in place.
Okay, now you can go back.
Right.
Representative Patrick
just said,
oh, no.
That
looks like a bid to me.
I was trying to get
some
stock back.
My tie, $800.
Okay, I think we've covered the administrative ratios on E9. The tables on E10 might be of some interest. These are really more for your reading at some point. I think they just indicate institutional setting, the type of custody, some other issues that might be important to you. We were asked, I believe, Mr. Chair, some time ago to give the operational dates on a couple institutions. This does some things that might be of interest to you, and I'll move on from that point. E12, E13, I'm going to talk just a little bit about security staff to inmate ratios, and I think we've done that to some degree. We probably have covered that in enough detail. There are a number of things that drive it. I mentioned several of those to Senator Timms. sometimes the co-ed nature of the facilities. One of the things that is the case now in the DOC, and we're going to get to this, I think, in just a moment, has a lot to do with the types of offenders that are there. Both at Snake River and TRCI, we've been able to segregate inmates into smaller management units for a variety of reasons. One has to do with the number of gang members and others in the institutions and the growing nature of the population. I'm going to go into programs and services of the institutional division on pages E15, E16. Some of the, and we'll go back and highlight these in just a moment. I'll just overlay them for you for a minute. Many of the things that occur inside the institution's division include classification, transfer, transportation units. We're responsible for the inmate custody classification, inmate transfers, interstate compact, and extradition, management of security threat groups, formerly known as gang management, the intensive management units, and rental bed contracts that we spoke of just earlier, and then monitoring DOC inmates placed in Oregon Youth Authority. Transportation division is responsible for the day-to-day movement of inmates from one location to another, obviously. In part, it's daily trips to court, to medical needs, to other kinds of activities that have to occur, including movement to other institutions. That should be enough of that. Interstate Compact, AG-15. This is the piece that has to do with inmates that are exchanged between one state and another. We have inmates residing in, I don't know how many different states in this nation at this point. With about 40 different states, and these are people that might be out there for protective custody or a whole bunch of other reasons, and we, by the very same token, have inmates in our institutions that are actually serving time for other jurisdictions.
Mr. Chairman?
Dave, on the interstate compact, are we currently holding any people that were in a situation like a rented bed in some other state and escaped, like the person in Texas or New Mexico or Arizona or wherever? That was a rented bed from that component. So are they now housed back here, or are they still housed in the scenario that they escaped from?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, unless Nick knows off the top of his head, I think the inmates that escaped in Texas, one of the big concerns down there was that they were in a private prison and that the escape laws did not pertain to them. I think that's been fixed in Texas. I believe those people were prosecuted and doing time there, although I think as one of those returned, the Houston escapes,
they
all returned, so they're all doing time in Oregon on convictions from Texas courts. They were convicted then. So they're serving original sentences in Oregon.
So what you're saying is private prisons don't have sanctioned capabilities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm, they do. In most states, I believe they did not in Texas. In this particular case, when those inmates, the two inmates escaped, Texas was not able to prosecute them under Texas law for escape because they were not, quote, a DOC or county institution.
So they're back here in Oregon being housed right now?
They're back here being housed for their original sentences. They were still under sentence when they were in the rental bed.
I see.
That sentence continued. They do not have additional charges pending or any new convictions because Texas did not prosecute them because they had no statute at the time to do it. They do now. So they were disciplined in our system, but they did not get additional time.
Okay.
I'm going to, Mr. Chair, I'm going to skip security threat group management unless there are questions about it, emergency preparedness issues. And I'm also going to skip the achievements piece that we have listed on E-17, 18, and 19. Because I think that there's enough information in the book to probably address your questions.
Can I ask one quick question?
Of course. With regard to the gang, you kind of alluded to it earlier, but that does affect your staffing ratios and how you can mix people in the population. It's not because you want too many of the gang members together in a group in a particular yard setting or whatever where it could be a big problem.
Yes, Representative Schrader, Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, the number of people identified as gang members or members of security threat groups has risen from about 300 in 1994 to 860 in 1999, more than doubling. And part of the thinking around the design at TRCI was that we would have smaller management areas, giving us more ability to place same gang members in the same institution but in separate housing units because they would never come into contact. Part of the problem with some of the older institutions like OSCI, EOCI, and the penitentiary is that when yard time occurs, a number of people are obviously mingled in a given location, and so the opportunity for events to occur in those settings is greater than it will be at a setting like TRCI. So as the number of gang members increases, if we don't have definite, distinct locations to place them, the process of managing gang members or threat group members is enhanced. And so if we only built large yard, dorm-style housing units, we would have a problem managing this particular population.
Okay.
Did that get at the question?
Okay.
Let me talk for just a minute, pages E18 and E19, if I can, please, around managing this organizational growth and development. As I said earlier, we're going to grow by about 1,600 offenders in the biennium. We have added two new assistant directors. Those are not new positions, but we brought people in to do that work. We've charged an existing position with being the chief of security. Nick, if you have questions, can talk more about that. Basically, to give us a high-level management position to deal with very, very specific, very important security issues. We've added five new superintendents to the mix. We brought in people from out of state with special skills. We've promoted people from within the department who have shown a promise and an ability to manage institutions. We have 10 new assistant superintendents that have been brought on board, replacing old, retired superintendents in some cases. I don't mean old, but retired. And in some cases, these are new positions as well. I should know when to keep my mouth shut.
How old did you mean?
I think I meant probably people of retirement age, sir. That could be any age. And one of the things that we've done effectively in terms of managing this growth is we have expanded our spot buy. And I think we've talked to you before about this, our spot buy opportunities that has dealt with approximately $1.5 million in savings at this point. How are we doing? I guess we're running out of time. Some of the performance measures for us during 1999-01 will be found on E18, or probably E19, E20. Our intention is to maintain our compliance rate without measure 17 at a 70% rate, with the commitment on our part to get to a 74% compliance rate by June 30th, 2001. Keeping in mind, if you will, that during that time we're going to have to add jobs to existing population to get up to that level, plus we're going to grow by 1,600 inmates. We're going to establish, and we have established in all of our facilities now, prison advisory committees. We're going to reduce institutional materials and supply costs by about 5% as a way to achieve a $3 million savings that we've committed to in our cuts. We have reduced our walkaways over the years because of a very aggressive attempt to recapture those people. Walkaways are basically a fact of life when we run minimum inmates outside the fences on work crews. We have dropped that significantly over the last several years. This year we'll have approximately 39 total. We'll go to 35 is our hope by the next year. And continue, you may have read in the Oregonian, continue our current status as for 3 years running now, having the lowest institutional drug usage percentage in the nation. And our goal is obviously zero tolerance. Right now we're averaging less than 1% of the offenders being tested on a random basis. Before we conclude, if I can hit one.
On the random basis, What is the criteria used to select a person for, is it previous drug usage that determines whether they go into a bucket, and we select out of that who's supposed to get the random test and who doesn't?
Well, it's more scientific than that, sir. The way we do it is all the inmates are in the bucket, and the computer, through a random number generator, selects that inmate, and we test 5% of all inmates every month. So it's possible an inmate could be tested 2 months in a row or not be tested at all for a given period of time, but a 5% analysis of 9,000 offenders is the way that we do it, and it's pretty much the protocol for assuring that people never know when they're going to be tested. In addition to that, we run dog tests through the institutions at about, I don't know, 50 a week, something like that. Maybe it's even greater than that, drug-sniffing dogs that move into cells. So we don't just do testing. We have a much more aggressive intervention with correctional officers, with our intensive or our drug unit that we use, including the drug dogs. Testing is what validates our success, I guess.
Do you also use the same principles towards the inmate guards and security people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hanna, we do not randomly test correctional officers.
Is there a potential for a problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hanna, there's always a potential for a problem. What we do, though, is ensure that through our management process that people who appear to be incapable of performing their roles for whatever reason, whether it's use of alcohol or other drugs, will be dealt with through the appropriate types of assistance programs. If these are people that are prolonged abusers, or if they are, in fact, distributing contraband inmates, they'll be terminated. Did I get at your question?
No, but I'll save it till later. I may have something else to ask you along with it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Dave, I remember when we made the cuts, I can't remember exactly when they were made, but we made the cuts in food service. I was amazed at the money we picked up in regards to that. And, of course, you mentioned the spot-buy purchasing. Well, I've been in the food service business all my life, so I'm somewhat familiar with how you save money with food. Now, I talked to him when I was in the prison of Snake River Valley about the purchasing or the hiring of the guy that was head of one of the biggest in the state of Oregon. You just hired the sales manager away from him to set up the warehouse and the purchasing of food. What I'd like to hear is how refined you are in dietary type things and what is served and money that can be saved. And we're talking millions and millions of dollars in food and fueling a system that's 365 days a year, 2,000. It's like owning a city, like Burns, for instance. And when you look at the advantages that you have in purchasing and totally of how you manage it, do you have a person that's an expert in those areas? To me, it's an area that you got to have somebody that knows the business.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, it is a city. 27,000 meals a day are being served in the institutions. We do have people who are experts at purchasing, people who are experts at food service delivery, people who are experts at dietetics. So all of those issues are being dealt with. We also have the responsibility to provide certain types of meals for health reasons, whether they're diabetics or some other situation. We also have responsibility for kosher meals being served. So it is like serving, not in a restaurant certainly, but serving a population that has specific needs. And we have hired, and you're right, we have hired some very skilled, very capable people to do this. And what we found is that by investing in professionals in security or professionals in healthcare or professionals in food service, we're more competitive. And I think that you mentioned earlier the competition. We are a very competitive organization. We are competitive within the Department of Corrections between institutions to serve highest quality food at lowest per deal or per diem cost, because food, and Nick can talk a long time about this, but food is one of the driving pieces behind successfully running institutions. People who can sleep well, even though they're inmates again, but can eat well, at least eat a reasonable a diet, and are taken care of in that respect, are much easier security issues to deal with for the day-to-day needs of the correctional officer and the Department of Corrections. So we've gone to a lot of trouble to design, and Sue can talk more about this later, the distribution center and other things to be competitive, to essentially put ourselves in a sort of a vertical integration of distribution for food and other products. And if we can buy, a train load of French fries from a distress sale, then we're going to do that. And we have done those kinds of things. And that's what having spot buy capability and having distribution centers is going to do for us. And that's why you're going to see a $3 million reduction in food and materials and services, because we're going to be competing with the big players in Oregon as far as moving product.
What's your total cost? You got a $3 million reduction. What's your total food cost per year?
About $30 million annually.
So you got a 10% cut.
Yeah, 10% cut on 27,000 meals a day.
I think you
that's about so $15 million a year. And it's a third, three, it's still a 10% cut on the biennium.
I would think we can do better, but.
Well, I think I hope we can do better, but what we believe we can do through the analysis is at least that. And I think that probably in the future we're going to have to expect to do better.
Now, why do you say that?
Because I think you're going to continue to squeeze our budget. And if we want to continue to run safe institutions, there aren't very many places to cut, and that means we have to cut in food service or cut in some other way, because we can't hire, as Representative Manning said, we cannot hire fewer security people. We are already in a position where, we are pretty finely balanced in that area.
And along that line, the budget that's before you relies on about $3 million in internal savings from institutions' budget to fund the distribution center startup and operations for this biennium, based on the assumption that they will save that amount of money in food purchases.
On the assumption?
Yes.
Not in there. On the assumption.
It's assumed. It's transferred from institutions to run the distribution center.
Yeah, it is a commitment from our point of view that we're going to do it.
Dave, don't be offended if the senator compared penal institutions to burn.
I'll try to get over it.
There's certain things that we don't eat as good in burns.
Well, they still think the world is flat in the bird.
Would you like me to see some
discussion? We got an archive center. What you guys got?
Yeah. They do, Senator. No, we're going to call it quits for the day. And, again, I just want to not only the committee, but the department to know we could go into what I guess I'd call flex mode here next week.
There are all kinds of interesting things coming up,
coming to us, bubbling, simmering.
At this time, I can tell you for sure that Monday will be public testimony day, and here Tuesday is a workshop for the judicial, and Wednesday will be the next opportunity at this time for you guys to resume.
And Monday may not be a public testimony.
This is Chair, I'll be in Longmont, Colorado, teaching at the National Institute of Corrections on Tuesday and Wednesday. So Mr. Armenicus can handle the load here, or we can wait and do institutions on Thursday, however you want to do it, and we'll bring IWP up on Wednesday.
I was waiting for Nick to talk. I was happy for Nick.
I'm waiting for him to talk, too. Thank you very much. I like
our work done. Do you have a quick question, Representative Schroeder?
Okay.
Okay. We are adjourned.
Great answer.